Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, free cash flow analysis for new projects. To begin in our traditional way, having a look at the markets, grim as they are, you can see that the Dow was down about 0.5%. The S&P 500 was down more than 1%, and the NASDAQ, of course, down almost 1.5%. The usual pattern, greater risk, greater movement. So it was a bear day, but interestingly enough, notice that the bears came in at the beginning of the day, and after they had their information impounded in the price, then it just kind of stabilized. It's just been kind of going do from there. Now, the crude oil market is actually surprisingly weak right now. Brent Sweet crude is, benchmark Brent is down to $94. A lot of that, there are a couple of explanations. One of them is, China's in a lockdown. That'll decrease the demand for oil. But the more important reason is simply that for all the sanctions that we are putting on Russia, because they're such monsters, they're getting around them and their oil's getting out into the onto the high seas. The difference between moral outrage and greed is in favor of greed right now. And so the buyers are taking what they can, getting the oil that's out there, finding ways around the sanctions. And Russia is figuring out how to reflag its ships so that they don't have Russian flag on them to get them around any kind of interdictions. So crude oil's having a good time. It won't last, but it's having a good time right now. And so your price of gas is going to go down kind of nicely for a while here. Going over, first of all, bond yields are up, which means the price of bonds are down. So investors are selling stocks, and they're selling the bonds. And look at this. Gold and silver are having a little bit of a strong day. So you're seeing money sort of like a second stage flight to quality. Getting out of stocks, you go to bonds. But if you're getting out of bonds too, the next thing you would go to is metals. And here we see at least some money going toward those. So that's a sign of some real pessimism when you see that happening. We'll see. Now, over on the other side of the world, London had a really nasty couple of drops, and at the end it was down pretty, not horribly, but the Nikkei had a real strong drop last night, and it barely started to recover early before it closed off. So we're not in a very good position right now as far as bulls are concerned. If you're a bear, this is a good market. See right here, this is a bear. This is one of them that's in my portfolio right now. It's a bet against the market. It's a bet specifically against the Standard & Poor's 500. And it is up nicely. And so I put about $100 in, and now I have about $200. And that's just because I am a pessimist and a cynic, and I thought it was going to do well. It hasn't done much since the beginning. Like I said, you see that most of what I made was when the S&P dropped right there at the beginning. And then the rest of it just kind of sitting there waiting to see what happens next. I'll probably hold it through the night and into tomorrow because I think the market has one more throw-up session in it tomorrow, but we'll see. Anyway, looking over here, one quick look. We still have the inversion of the yield curve on the 710. The rest of it has fixed itself. No. Yes, it has. Yeah. It has repaired itself. But still, you've got that. And more of the big houses, economics analysis houses and trading houses, are now calling a recession at the end of the year. So they're mostly agreeing with me that it's not going to be a severe recession, but it will be, I think probably it will, the Christmas season will boost the economy. And then after that, it'll just be a drop off in January. So the recession will probably start right at the beginning of 2023. So, you know, plan accordingly and stay in school so that you don't have to find a job right away and you don't have to be drafted right away either if things get out of hand. Enough of that. Free cash flow. I've talked about it. I've shown you the equation of free cash flow several times, and now the free cash flow FCF equals your operating income or your EBIT, whatever you want to call it, and then you take that times your tax rate, and then you add back the depreciation expense because it really didn't happen. You have it in here because it has a nice tax shield effect. And then you take out your capital expenditures, and then you take out your change in net operating working capital. And I'll show you one of these again. And I do plan to actually show you sort of a real problem. It was, the numbers are cleaned up so that they're nice big round numbers, but it's pretty much what happened with one company. I've got a couple that I can show you how it worked, but this is not a terribly math lecture. Even this whole subject is just sort of like Excel stuff, as long as you remember all of the rules beforehand. And that's what I talk about today. It's what goes into this before you start attacking and throwing numbers at it. And your book does an example with Home Depot, which is actually kind of a nice example. But there are a number of pointers along the way that I want to bring up. One of them is just a quick cleanup on the idea of salvage value, using the salvage value. Now, the salvage value can be positive or negative, but you have to remember that we are going to need the after-tax salvage value, and that would be the pre-tax. Now, here's where it gets a little bit difficult, because in accounting, you have a book value that's declining with your depreciation expense every year. Now, that book might be less than what you sell it at. You would have to say, we need to take the salvage value minus any book value that was still on there, and that's going to be taxable. So you're going to have to take 1 times 1 minus your tax rate to get the after-tax salvage value. I'll show you a quick, dirty example of this. Okay? So suppose that you are able to sell your old equipment for, let's say, $5,000. But you haven't depreciated it down all the way. And so what you want to do is you're going to need to say there's a book value still there. And let's say that's $1,000. So you're going to be taxed on $4,000. You're going to have to pay a tax on that. To get after taxes what you get from it. Okay? Okay, so now, there's an interesting side to this, though. This works positive and negative. Suppose that you have remediation costs. So in that case, you have remediation is your salvage value. And let's say that that is $10,000. Now that's going to have no book value. It's not something that was on your books at all. So in other words, that is a negative number, so that's actually going to be a tax shield to you. You're going to, the after-tax salvage value is going to be that negative 10,000, but it will be at what you'll pay only 1 minus the tax rate. Because it was a negative, it's a shield to you. So in other words, that cost is going to knock you dead, but then you're going to say to yourself, okay, actually, we get to subtract that on our taxes. That'll give us some shield. So it won't be 10,000. It will be something like, if we're in the 21% marginal tax bracket, this would end up being only a 7,900 negative, would be your after-tax salvage value. Because you get to deduct it from your taxes. So it kind of acts as a shield there. Now, the odd thing about this is that the Congress in 2017 dropped the marginal tax rate from 39% down to 21% at the top, which actually reduced the shield that would arise from negative salvage values, which is kind of hilarious when you think about it, because it was all for making businesses have lots more money, and yet it has this unintended consequence of reducing the protection of costs that a company incurs. It's just kind of a side note there. It's something just to keep in mind. Okay, taking that off, that's kind of the end of the math, and then this story gets a little interesting. Because the first thing when we talk about cash flows to decide whether to go or no go with a project, we always, always consider only the incremental revenues and costs. Only those that occur because of this project. In other words, we sandbox the project. We treat it as if it is not in the company, it is something that is external to the company right away. So we have to keep that in mind, is that we're going to make some exceptions here. And I'll show you those, and those are where it gets really interesting. It gets into marketing and stuff like that. But right off the bat, we need to look at incremental cash flows to do this work that we're doing here. Now, a couple of things are worth talking about seriously here. Costs. The worst one that is, we see this more often than you might imagine in these project analyses, capital budgeting that companies do, is they include sunk costs, which you should never include. A sunk cost is a cost that has already been incurred. You're not going to recover it. And it is a source of misunderstanding in a number of companies. I'll give you an example. Okay, a company did a feasibility study for a new project. They did blueprints, they did a marketing analysis and all of this, and then they got down to doing the numbers. So they put that into that year zero negative. How much did we spend on these blueprints? How much did we spend on these marketing studies? Absolutely not. They're over. You've already spent that money. Whether the project is a go or a no go, that money is already gone. It is in heaven, living with the angels. It's not there anymore. So you cannot consider a cost that you've already incurred. You've already spent that money. Don't look back on it. As I've mentioned before, there were companies, the one example always stands out in my mind. They were talking about going to the next phase of a project. It was going to be $1.5 million, something like that. And the CEO of the company at the meeting says, well, we've already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, so, I mean, we've got to keep going. That money is gone. It has nothing whatsoever to do with whether you go to phase two or not. has nothing whatsoever. I they knew I was pretty blunt with them. I said, where is that money? He said, what do you mean, where is that money? It's right here. And he was pointing at these documents and all this kind of stuff. No, that's not. That's paper. That money has already been spent. Whether or not you go with this project, whether or not we do phase two, has nothing whatsoever to do with that money that has already gone into this project. That's the hardest thing in the world for people to talk about. Well, I already spent, one is great in among people who sell houses. Well, I just put last year $18,000 into this house, so that's got to increase the value. No, it doesn't. The market's going to decide what that house is worth. Your improvements mean nothing. They were for you. They're for no one else in the world. So no, you can't, well, I just got new brakes on this car, so I should have a better book value on this when I trade it in. No, you won't. That's not part of the equation. I mean, they'll just look at you and they'll nod their head, but they're not going to include your brand new or your radio you put in there or anything like that. It's already spent money. And it has nothing to do with the future expected cash flows from the project. So sunk costs, never in a project. So that's a no. The one that is a real bad one, though, is opportunity costs, which is a yes. What is the best thing you gave up? And that is ignored so much. When you use that plot of land to do this project, well, we already had that land. That was what they did over there in our Twin City when they were building that arena. Well, we don't include the cost of the land because the city already owns that land. No, no, no. You could have rented that land for something else. You could have sold that land. It is a cost of this project, whether you own it or not. And that's one that is just ignored so much. Well, we're just going to shift some of our resources, and are you going to include those costs? Well, no, we already got those employees. We already got that backhoe. No, no, that's just the point, is you are giving up the next best alternative, which would be to keep those people in the projects they're in, which would be to use that, sell that piece of equipment, whatever. It is still a cost, so opportunity costs are just critical, and they're sometimes kind of hard to figure out. But you can find a market value for almost anything that is going to be used in a project. Even if you own it, it's still something you're using in that project. Okay, so that's that. Now, let me go over here to this incremental. You look only at the revenues and the expenses of this project, separate from the rest of your company, the rest of your projects that are already done, already underway, whatever. You don't look at those at all, unless. And you've got to be careful about doing this because it is overused, but it is there. From economics, we get the term externalities. There are negative externalities, and there are positive externalities. I'll give you an example of a negative. It's called cannibalism. This project, what it creates, might cannibalize revenues from another project, another product you have. That is something that companies, astute companies, Fortune 500 companies, even smaller companies, they are fully aware that they have to make products that do not eat into the revenues of other products they have. The best examples that I give are from car companies, where they make very sure that if they bring in a new vehicle, that they do not damage the revenues of a vehicle that exists already in their lineup. Some companies go to the extent of completely rebranding cars so that they don't interfere. For example, does anyone know who makes Lexus? It's what, Toyota, right? Yeah. They're not going to take any chance that someone who buys a Lexus would see a Toyota as an alternative. Another one would be Infiniti, which is who? You know that one? That's Nissan. There's another one. How about Acura? Yep. They are not going to let those high-end cars touch their existing models. That would be cannibalism, and they want to avoid it. A number of car companies, I don't know whether I've talked about this or not, the car companies do what's called demographic tracking. They will create a car like a low-end. Give you an example. Nissan, many years ago, had a low-end starter car called the Sentra. It was kind of a box car. But as time went on, they wanted to keep that consumer group with the Sentra by upgrading the Sentra from a starter car to an intermediate to what is now almost like a really nice, it's not a luxury, but it's a really nice higher-end vehicle. They just tracked that group that started with the Sentra, and as those young people started growing up, looking a little nicer, getting good jobs, the Sentra looked nicer, and then the Sentra got bigger so that they could have families, smaller families, and they could still have a Sentra, and it still looked like a car for that demographic. Another example of that was Toyota. Some years back, they had a little, it was an adorable little sort of almost SUV. It was called the RAV4. Now, if you look at RAV4s now, they're a regular SUV. Slightly smaller, but very nice. And the interiors of them are really great looking. So that, well, they can be if you pay for the options and all that. But they tracked a demographic group. And then they can put in a car underneath it that is for a younger crowd. Example with Subaru. The Outback. Another one would be the Forester. Forester, back in the 80s, or 90s, I should say, was a boxy carry-all, a little box on wheels. Now, that's a really high-end. They've got only one higher car, the Ascent, I believe, but they track the demographic. And that way, they can put in a lower model without interfering with the sales of the model that is tracking a demographic. This is a very normal procedure for companies to do, to prevent cannibalism of an existing line. Some companies even go to the extent, as I said, in rebranding. On the downscale side, there are generic brand. There's a generic label called Equate for a number of products, mostly household consumer goods. Everything from contact lens cleaner to soap, hand soap, body soap, Equate. Those products are actually made by the normal manufacturers. But they're made for people who don't have as much money and for a crowd of people who fancies itself the common person. They don't buy the fancy stuff at all. So there you have split the market. It's called market discrimination. And you just split the market by completely rebranding to the low side. Good example of that was a major cigarette manufacturer many years ago created a pseudo-generic brand called GPC. It got so popular among the working class that it became almost a premium cigarette. So yeah, this happens all the time. And it's purely to protect from the cannibalism that can happen on products as new products are introduced. Or when you want to penetrate a new market with the same product, but you don't want cannibalization of sales on the existing product. You just make another one that looks different, call it a different name, make it cheaper or more expensive, and there's your Uncle Bob. You got a double cash flow. Nice stuff. Okay, cannibalism is one side of it. Positive externalities. You've got to be careful because there are some marketing types who will say, well, this product is going to enhance all these other brands. So, yeah, we don't need to look at just its cash flows. We need to look at the incrementals that it will create in all the other products in our line. That is a fool's way of thinking about it. However, you can create positive externalities by, for lack of other terms, one term you can use is piggyback. A product that is meant to go with an existing product to enhance revenues of both of them. Great example of this is with computer printers. Computer printers are ridiculously cheap. You can get, in some cases, you can buy a computer and they'll throw in a printer. You can get a printer that prints at really high quality for, in some cases, under $60. Why would they do that? They're basically blowing the cash, free cash flow of the printer by making it so cheap. Well, that's simply because once you buy the printer, then you're going to need these ridiculously expensive inks, especially if it prints really nice and pretty. Oh, that thing is going to slurp ink. And then you're going to go out and replace that printer cartridge, and the first thing out of your mouth will be, that printer cartridge is how much? OMG, yes, they'll do that. As a matter of fact, some companies are so brazen about it. HP, their printers are really cheap, but their inks are expensive, and they have their own HP brand of paper, knowing very well that a lot of people are going to be too stupid to understand that you don't need HP printer paper with HP printers. Well, I guess I got an HP printer, so I better buy their paper too, because I want the right paper for it. It's just paper, but HP enhanced their sales, piggybacked sales of the paper, by selling the printer at virtually a loss. No cash, a very low free cash flow from the printers, but you make all of this money off the side products, the piggybacking products. The greatest examples in the world of this are not in print, well, that's great examples, but in the field of health and health care. You get a diabetes monitor, blood sugar monitor, blood glucose monitor. The monitor is cheap, extraordinarily cheap. It's in a nice electronic device, very accurate, has to be. But my God, after you send in the coupon for the rebate, well, you're going to get that monitor for close to nothing. But they will make their money off the lancets, those little things that stick into your finger. They will make their money off the alcohol pads. They will also make their money because now that they know who you are, they will sell you the diet plans, the exercise plans, and all of the other things that go along with having diabetes. In other words, one of the biggest transformations in healthcare over the last 20 years has been to turn diseases, conditions, syndromes, and illnesses into lifestyles, to make it so that you have multiple flows of income from the very fact that you are sick. Guarantee you, I have Asperger's syndrome. Somewhere along the line, somehow it got to the marketers that that's on the autism spectrum. So there are they come. The sales on the stuff for people with autism, the lifestyle adjustments, the food plans, the monitors, the timers, because they know that we live by clocks. We're obsessed with them. All of that just by virtue of the fact that they found out that I don't have a condition, I don't have a syndrome, I have a lifestyle, and they're going to sell it to you. You go on a diet, you're going to go on a diet, and then you're going to buy the diet recipes, you're going to buy a stupid treadmill that you'll use for 2 weeks and say FTS, you're going to buy all those things that go along with being on a diet. The externalities are phenomenal. Cancer, it's a lifestyle, living with cancer, the foods you eat, the things that you can do. Let's talk to you on this subscription service about dealing with family members. What the hell? You see, this is the whole thing, is that externalities can be there. You have to know where they are, and you have to have a certain level of insensitivity to the issue at hand, and you can make money. Those are the externalities. So don't forget those in the free cash flow analysis. There is the potential for cannibalism. Is this product going to take sales away from another product? There's also the problem, there's also the opportunity that you will be able to create multiple streams off a single product, and from that, and sometimes you can do something like a Starbucks. Well, we are virtuous. We're going to go away from paper cups to save the world. Oh, how are we going to get our coffee in our hands? Oh, no, we will have these mugs that you can buy. You understand how you can leverage. I gather that in your marketing, have you had your marketing class yet here? Did they teach you about consumer choice architecture? No, they didn't. You have to get up there a ways. Consumer choice architecture, you create the conditions where people think that they're making their own decision, but you have made the decision, or at least helped them make the right decisions. On a survey, slight changes can be made in placing of products on the shelves. That's consumer choice architecture, where you put the brands that you want people to buy, where you put the brands of the different demographic groups so that they don't look at things that aren't in their group and freak out. You don't want a kid seeing high-fiber cereal. Oh, no, Mommy, I don't want that cereal. That cereal makes me go to the toilet too much. Oh, shut up. It's good for me. Yeah, you want to place things where they will work, and away from where they won't. You go to the checkout, that screen that you it'll go cash back. You notice all the buttons for choosing cash back and just one small button for no, I don't want cash back. Because they make money if you ask for cash back. This is consumer choice architecture, giving people the illusion of free will when you know very well that that's the last thing you want out of a consumer, because they might not buy your damn products. Externalities. Kind of an interesting subject in itself. Marketing used to be fun to teach, but I'm not allowed to teach it anymore because I tell people the evil that we do. But remember, you're business people. That is not your problem. Your problem is to increase the revenues, increase the free cash flows, because that's how you are going to stay in business. That's how you are going to enhance shareholder wealth, by making it look good, and that will help increase your revenues. Talking about being a green company that enhances. Well, this is a green product that will enhance your revenues because people will feel good about themselves. Whether or not it's green, well, you know, we'll figure out something. You know, we'll throw some... Well, we'll throw in a bag of weed with it. There's your green. Anyway. Now, but the important thing, though, is that remember that you've got to sandbox a project. In anything you talk about, negative and positive, you look at that objectively. Can this be done? And then you go from there. And if it can, then you include that in the incremental revenues and or costs of the making of the product. Okay. Now, the last part of this this preview, as it were, is simply to make the mention that keep in mind that I'm going to give you an examples of this. It's not really, it looks like it's some kind of awesome, complicated thing, but it's really just a stupid Excel sheet. And we do it, but numbers mean nothing if you haven't thought about them before you put them in. Once you put them in, Excel can do the whole stupid thing. It's that thought process that I was doing here that's what matters to saying yes to a project versus saying no to a project and being at least having a good chance of being right about it being a home run or a loser. That's all I have for you today.